Well, it's just coming up to dinner time here at Rockwood and the close of day two of the 2023 Sunshine Coast Festival of the Written Arts. I'm Sean Eckford, a director here at the festival and producer of our daily podcasts. Before we highlight today, let's turn briefly back to yesterday's late events. Journalist Angela Sterrett was on stage to discuss her book Unbroken, which follows her work to bring attention and justice for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. It's interwoven with her own story. And here's what she told an audience member who wanted to know how her mixed heritage influences how she approaches her work.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I definitely feel a bit of a responsibility. I mean, I think that comes with being Indigenous, you know, like being brought into my house group. It's not like, ooh, like something I can just use, like now you have to pay up kind of thing, right? You owe a lot of money. It's a big responsibility in modern terms, which is in many ways monetary. So it's expensive, but it's a responsibility. I think being part white or mostly white, I think that's also another point of responsibility. I just feel like, you know, sometimes I'm like, how come I can see it? And they, I mean, I guess because I can see, because I have an experience, but I just feel like as white people, we have to speak up. We have to say something. We have to do something. We have to use any type of power, point of power that we have to those who are the least disadvantaged in our society. You know, they always say, you can tell where a society's at by the way the most vulnerable is treated, you know? And as Indigenous women, we're pretty low. You know, there was a missing and murdered Indigenous woman's national inquiry, and they gave 233 recommendations in 2019. It's 2023, and only two or three have been fulfilled, right? So that's the message that we get from our country about how much we matter. And I just feel like, yeah, it's a responsibility that I have on both sides. And I think, I think it definitely plays a role, among with a lot of other experiences. But I think it's the least I can do, right? As a person who is white, is use my voice, use my power, use my privilege for others, to uplift those who need it the most.
Angela was followed by science journalist Bob McDonald, whose new book, The Future Is Now, explores the already existing technologies that could be the basis of a green future, but not without some bottom-up pressure from citizens. As he explained in an answer to one of the questions after his presentation.
I think you've amply demonstrated that the technological solutions are available. But it seems to me that we haven't attacked the political problems. We've had a premier who's stopped renewable energy development in their province. We haven't attacked the financing. How do you finance these things? Because a lot of it difficult to finance. Developing countries in particular can't get the money for it. And then the economic issues, you know. A lot of these things aren't yet economically viable, so businesses aren't taking them up or developing them.
Well, first of all, in terms of the politics, vote smart. And like I say, I don't believe the change is going to come from the top down. The role of the government is to finance research, finance our universities and technological advances, cutting edge stuff that people can't afford to do, and support that. The governments can also step in with infrastructure. So things, for example, in the States, they have Electrify America program, which is to install charging stations so that you can drive an electric car from coast to coast. We don't have that in Canada yet. So that's where the government can step in with infrastructure. Just like they provide roads, they can provide charging stations for electric vehicles, for example. But when you say the economics don't work, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that because I have spoken to companies that are building these things and they are making money at it. And it looks like, and if you're thinking about it for your home, yeah, it can look expensive at the front end, to install solar panels. They can look really expensive at the front end. But if you look at it over the long term, and how long, what's the payback time before your energy bills go to zero and you made up what you're paying for natural gas or whatever you're using in your home now? So that's it's long-term thinking, not just the upfront costs. A lot of people get stopped by that. And there are government incentives to help with that as well. So I think we can make that economic argument and not let it slow us down. You know, we spend money on so many things. Do you know that, like, people talk about the space program. I'm a big space guy. They say, well, why are we spending all that money in space when we could be spending it here on the ground, you know, solving social problems? Well, the Canadian space program, if you take the total budget of the Canadian space program and divide it by the population of Canada, it works out to less than $10 a year. $10. We spend more on Halloween than we do on the space program. We spend more on Halloween. What's it cost to go to a hockey game now, right? What do you spend on beer? Come on. So there's lots of places where we have money that we're spending it, and we just blow it away and say, okay, that's fun for entertainment or whatever. So we can focus this. We need to think about where our energy is going to come from and how we're going to use the energy to make it as efficient as possible. So I just don't agree that it's economically bad. Like I say, it's a fast-growing sector of the economy. People are investing in it. I gave a talk to investors in Victoria. There was a conference of investors. They invited me to come and talk about this, and they were all in agreement. And they bought this thing up. I sold a whole bunch of them there. It was unbelievable. This is a great opportunity, man. Well, I see it. This is the future. What are you talking about? So they love it. So I think we can turn that train around. I think we can. Yeah.
So that brings us to today, which opened with humor, courtesy of Victoria Times columnist writer Jack Knox. His latest collection is Fortune Knox Once, More Musings from the Edge. In giving a summary of his accomplishments as a journalist, which are many, Jack mentioned in passing that he once had a call from Barack Obama just 4 days before he was first elected president. Naturally, someone in the audience wanted a few more details.
Barack Obama actually had an aide from Victoria. Was a guy called Marvin Nicholson, and they ended up becoming good friends. Whenever Obama wanted to go golfing throughout his presidency or to go shoot baskets behind the White House, Marv was his guy. During Obama's first campaign, all the Canadian media wanted to talk to Obama's Canadian, but he didn't want to do interviews. Fortunately, his mother in Victoria liked my column. So to make his mother happy, Marv agreed to an interview, and I got a voicemail one day going, "This is Marv. I'm in Des Moines, Iowa. It was on Halloween. We're going into Chicago tonight. Barack's taking his girls trick-or-treating. So that'll give me time to give you a call. And afterwards, he can give you a couple of minutes if you like." And that's what he did. Obama phoned me up, and I thought, okay, he knows he's either won or lost the election, because there aren't a lot of votes in the Victoria Times columnist. And he called me up from Gary, Indiana, just to talk about Marv. And I said, okay, is there going to be room in the White House for Marv if you win? And he goes, of course there is. But the important thing is that he find a good woman, settle down, and start having some grandchildren for his mother in Victoria. And in the next seat on the campaign bus, I could hear Marv going, "Brock, shut up, man. Brock, shut up." And I thought that was actually really endearing, because there was no advantage to Obama in calling me, and there was no advantage to Marv in calling me, other than he just wanted to make his mother happy, and Obama wanted to make Marv happy. So I like that.
Danny Ramadan also gave us a few laughs, talking about his new novel, The Foghorn Echoes, and his other work, and also noting how cold it was in our pavilion this morning. I caught up with Danny while he was signing books afterwards.
Oh gosh, the festival has been fantastic. I'm really enjoying seeing all of those wonderful friends of mine on the stage doing their art, as well as the audience. They're so delightful, genuinely. Like, I get a lot of audience, and a lot of people just sit in the back and just like clap politely, while your audience are like laughing a full-hearted laugh and just like talking to me so lovingly. So it just makes so much a big difference, honestly.
kind of warms you up on a cold morning, picking up on a theme.
I mean, to be honest, I'm wearing a Barbie pink sweater now, which goes with who I am and my style, so that's great. I'm really happy about that.
I noticed at one point in your presentation, you gave the audience a choice of what they wanted to hear you read from, and I'm thinking that must have actually been a little nerve-wracking. You're going, what are they going to pick? Which way are they going to go?
I mean, you phrase any question the right way, and you know exactly where it's going to go. Hey, would you like me to read again from something that I just read from, or would you like me to read something brand new? People are all going to go with the brand new, right? So it's a calculated risk, and I was aware that it might go either way, but chances are it was going to go the way that I wanted it to go, right? Yeah, it was fun.
While you were here, was there anyone in particular you were keen to see and that you got a chance to see on stage?
So I'm a massive fan of John and his books, John Valiant. It's honestly, his work is so... You feel like he understands things that my basic layman mind doesn't. And then he comes to you and he's like, oh, this is how this works. I'm like, oh, thank you. He's just such a beautiful speaker and I adore him. I also am friends with a lot of the folks who are on the stage, so I hanged out with Megan Cole, I hang out with Tara McGuire, I hanged out with Janie Chang. All of those folks are fantastic friends of mine, so I'm really glad that I got to spend some time with them.
And you also mentioned your children's books.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, because we don't specifically cater to it, audience of children here, but what's your experience been like talking to kids when you get a chance about those books?
I get invited to a lot of schools to talk to kids about the books, and the thing about kids is that when they're asking questions, speaking of Q&A, they are interested in the weirdest little things. Like, for example, a kid raised their hand and they're like, so what is your favorite color? And you have to like think on the spot of such a simple question, because you don't expect it, and be like, what is my favorite color? Turns out is royal purple.
Ah.
Yeah, I love that color. Also, royal purple is a marriage between yellow and blue, and those are my three favorite colors, so look at that.
We started the day with humor, but we didn't shy away from hard topics. Tara McGuire's Holden, After and Before, is a hybrid of memoir and fiction, subtitled A Love Letter for a Son Lost to Overdose. She was in conversation with the Globe and Mail's Andrea Wu.
But I've learned that we don't know how to be around death very much. I've learned a lot about how natural it is to die. Not when you're young, obviously, but that we're really ill-equipped to help each other. You know, I've learned a lot. I'm way better at helping people now when they have shitty things happen. I can be present in a way I think that is valuable for others. I'm a way better mother now with our daughter. Like, the relationship that we have is one of the most valuable things of my life. And helping her navigate this has been, while excruciating, also rewarding. She's such a person of depth now. I don't know if she wouldn't have been, but those things, like, it's changed me, it's changed my relationships with people, it's changed how I view our time here, for sure.
What advice would you offer to people who may be using writing to as a means of healing, of grieving, and honoring their own experiences?
It's very super powerful. Yeah. I mean, write it all down. Also, when you lose someone, you've probably all had an experience of loss. Weird things happen with your memory. And our counselor at the very beginning said, you know, don't trust your memory. You won't remember a lot of this. If it's important to you, write it down. She also said you'll be a terrible driver and you'll have like lousy depth perception, like all these weird things that happen to your brain when your psyche is so shocked that you cannot comprehend what is happening. And so that was really good advice, you know, to write that down. And I would recommend that, regardless of if you're going to publish it or not or whatever you want to do, just write it down, because I would go back and read through things that I had written with no memory of having written them, like none. I'm like, who wrote this? Wow. Yeah, so I would say that writing is a very powerful way to process It doesn't make the grief less, doesn't make it go away, doesn't do anything to change the shape of it or the pain of it, but it helps you it helped me articulate it in a way that I could kind of like take it from this big jello thing into something a bit more solid, if that makes sense.
Now, as we get ready for our dinner break, we're anticipating this year's Rockwood Lecture. Jody Wilson-Raybould, author most recently of True Reconciliation, How to Be a Force for Change. We'll have more on that tomorrow. And speaking of tomorrow, it's going to be another full day to check out the event schedule and maybe get some tickets if you don't already have them yet. Visit writersfestival.ca.